green form, miss. A man takes a drop too much once in a while. It's only human nature. Nature, Mr. Allnut, is what we are put in this world to rise above. Hello, and welcome to episode 190 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other renegades and vigilantes, that's a funny way of describing it, as masterpieces. I am Nick, I am the prim and proper religious type on this podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
Grunt. Glug.
And we are back in sort of familiar territory in that we are talking about another John Huston film. It's been a while. I can't remember the last one we talked about, but he is the...
Sarah Baudry.
Oh, yes, yeah. He's the director of some films that I think we both thoroughly enjoyed. Sierra Madre, one of my favourite films of all time, The Man Who Would Be King, and some others that we didn't like so much, like that that one at the wedding. Not the wedding. The posh meal, the immortals was
the dead.
The dead. That was the opposite of the immortals.
Yeah, when I was looking around for that, there was another film called that that came out the next year, which was not at all the same sort of thing.
Yeah, I can imagine. But this week, this episode, we are discussing 1951's possible masterpiece, The African Queen.
We are back to Bogart.
Hmm. It's in our wheelhouse. It's not black and white, sadly, but it is a director we love. It's some actors we love. I don't know that we've had... I want to say Kathleen Turner, but Catherine Hepburn. I don't know why I get those two mixed up. I don't know that we've had Catherine Hepburn before on Ribbon of Memes.
I don't think so. Certainly, I've seen a lot of her films. I am generally... I don't think I've ever not enjoyed one of her performances.
Yes, an excellent actor. And it really is mostly a twofer with those two and a few other performances at the top and tail. But for the most part, this is a road movie, a proto-road movie, in that we have two disparate characters who start off not very keen on each other. And it progresses. So we are... we open in... do we know what African country? It's sort of an undisclosed African
country. In a technical sense, we do. So this is explicitly happening in German East Africa, which state existed between 1885 and 1918. In terms of modern countries, it's Burundi, Rwanda, mainland Tanzania, and a little bit of Mozambique.
Okay.
And obviously, from the date you can work out, it got broken up at the end of the war.
Okay, so what is now several countries in East Africa?
Yeah,
but was German East Africa,
and it is either is already or is just about to be the First World War.
It's right at the start of the First World War. Yes, presumably 1914 or early 1915, depending on when it all kicked off in Africa. And we are in a mission. In a small East African village, and we have the lovely Robert Morley leading the singing, and it's a nice opening scene. I like it. I like the kind of slightly bored / confused / interested, but singing in a very different way faces of the African people as they try and. It's such a weird thing to try and turn these East African villages into like small English villages. I never quite understood the impulse to push people into exactly that culture when it doesn't really match theirs at all.
The theory is, as I understand it, that if you do not worship God in the exact right way out of all the thousands of ways available, you are doomed forever. And if you genuinely believe that, then it could be really important to let other people know that as well.
It's not a thing I personally follow
because I feel that if God is like that, then it doesn't deserve our worship. But hey, that's me.
Totally agree.
It is lovely to see Robert Morley again.
Also,
we've seen him rather later in High Road to China and in Theatre of Blood. But by then, he's he put on a bit of weight. He doesn't really move a whole lot. He's essentially doing bit parts.
And, well, he's a bit of a caricature of himself in the later roles we see.
Or at the very least, he can play it. I mean, he was writing entertainingly in Punch. Well, after both of those films, so, you know,
okay.
He was not a complete joke. But here he is clearly he is comedic, but he is also a real actor, and you can see that he's a real actor, and that is just lovely.
Yes, yes. So he's leading the congregation in singing, along with his sister, who played by Katharine Hepburn, this is Rose,
mm-hmm.
And we have the arrival of the African Queen. Now, I have seen the African Queen before a long time ago. In my head, the African Queen was much, much bigger. So it's a pretty small steamship. Steam-powered.
I think steam launch would be fair.
Yeah, it's not more than a...
Clearly not really designed to make independent voyages.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It hasn't got a lower deck as far as we can see. It's just got a covered area.
It's an open boat with a steam engine and an awning.
Yes, yeah. It's about, 20 foot long? We have Charlie arrives being...
And this is basically the line of communication with the outside world. Yeah, he's bringing the mail, he's bringing the any supplies people have asked for, and whatever else.
And he's sort of an entrepreneur, and travels between here and the mines and does a bit of trading, as far as we can tell. It is Humphrey Bogart, of course, who... he's Humphrey Bogart, really. I mean, he doesn't do a lot of different... He hasn't got a wide range, especially, but he's so good at what he does.
I think this is quite similar to the early Bogart in Treasure of the Sierra Madre, which, of course, is only 3 years earlier. He is the bum. He has obviously landed up here, and you know he is a competent mechanic, and competent mechanics can get jobs somewhere else. He has landed up here for a reason, which we never know.
No,
which in a way is kind of a shame, but yeah, maybe.
I suspect we might not like him as much if we did know.
The key thing I think is that he clearly doesn't have a way out. He's made his peace with it. He's reasonably happy with what he's doing, but. This is a dead-end job, and he knows it.
Yes. He is Canadian, which I assume is because... I think in the original book, is he a Cockney?
Yeah. And they the first draft of the script put thick Cockney dialect, and Bogart looked at it and said, no, can't do that, mate.
Fair enough. A man's got to know his limitations. Now, presumably he's Canadian rather than American, because that puts him in the Commonwealth and therefore at war with Germany, is that right?
Not entirely clear to me, I've got to say.
But he is, despite Bogey being American and acting entirely American, he's randomly Canadian here. I think that must be for plot purposes, but I'm not quite sure. That's my suspicion. He's got to have some reason to actually feel aggrieved and want to fight the Germans. Even though they've wrecked his whole livelihood, you'd think they could just pop that in. Anyway, he pops there. There's a very awkward and very nicely played genteel English tea scene with Robert Morley and Katharine Hepburn trying to have a sort of prim and proper English high tea and with...
In the middle of the awkward, jungle, yeah.
In the middle of the jungle. And even so, they're so imperious about it that that Charlie feels... very out of place, even though it's really them that's out of place. I have to say,
in terms of sheer acting talent rather than emotional impact or whatever, this is probably the most impressive scene of the film for what Bogart does here. The way he just portrays the discomfort.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not saying he's a bad actor. He's just not got a huge range.
I'm saying here specifically, he's even better than I expect him to be.
Yes, yeah, that's good. It's a really nicely built-up scene. And so he tootles off again.
We should note, by the way, a production note, because it's actually relevant to some of this, that in the scene in the church, there is a bucket placed off-camera so that Hepburn can throw up into it.
I also read that the two people who weren't affected by the gastrointestinal problems were the director and Bogart.
Who claimed it was because they drank exclusively whiskey, yeah.
Very good. And I think that's believable. I don't think Bogie was quite on a level of Richard Burton in our last episode.
But I would like to say that it's a technical achievement that's possibly a bit lost. These are three-strip Technicolor cameras. And this isn't the first time they've been used on location, but these are big bastards. And, yeah, it's... For the day, it was amazing to have that quality of colour film from such a remote place.
Well, yeah, this is mostly on location, the whole film. There are a little bit of studio work.
Basically, some of the water stuff is shot in a tank.
Yes, which makes sense given what... I would say it's not obvious to me which is and which... I mean, like, logically, you can kind of work it out from what the actors are doing, but, visually... It cuts very well. I thought it looks $1 million. It's a good looking film. So
this is also the little technical point. In the book, this is a C.S. Forrester's book, 1935, I think.
Which I haven't read. I haven't read any of Forrester's.
They're Anglican missionaries. Now, both of those things are plausible, but Anglicans have bishops. Methodists do not. So, yeah, they casually changed the thing for whatever reason, perhaps to avoid causing offence or whatever, but they didn't have anybody there who knew that, yeah, you should change the line and yes, Methodists have people who are important in their religious power structure, but they are not called bishops.
takes me back to... the Knives Out film where they changed it round a little bit so that it wouldn't be Catholics, but it doesn't quite work.
Well, basically the guy was brought up in American Evangelical, but he didn't like the aesthetic, which I can see, because the American Evangelical aesthetic, as he said and as I have seen, is basically Pottery Barn.
it's less gothic.
But anyway this also gives us a certain amount of setup. You know, the Germans are out there and they're being a bit arsey.
Yes, Charlie informs them that a war has started, which they were unaware of, one account of them being in the middle of nowhere. He tootles off on the African Queen, and I think it's later that same day or the next day, the Germans arrive and behave... Unfortunately, I think much as they did in real life, which is burn the villages to mobilise the Africans to either get out of the way or to use them as troops.
Well, you've got nowhere to sleep, you've got nothing to eat, come and fight for us.
Yes. So it's entirely accurate. They burn down the village, they burn down the church, and this causes... I don't know, a conniption in Robert Morley. But his character, the brother, I don't know if he ever gets a name, actually, or not in the film, I don't recall it. But he goes into a fever and pretty shortly afterwards dies. He is, to be fair, clubbed by one of the Germans, so he may have picked up an infection.
Yeah, one can't say from what is portrayed on film exactly what the cause might be. I think it is worth bearing in mind, though, the novel is 1935, and at that point, it is the commonest belief, and this is something you get from reading popular fiction of the day in general, but in Britain, which is where the primary audience of the novel is, the general feeling is World War One was a great mistake, which could have been avoided. The Germans are basically noble and chivalrous opponents of us, are also noble and chivalrous.
So in the book, do they behave more nobly?
No, they still behave poorly to the natives.
Right.
Because who cares about them? But
that doesn't count.
Yeah.
Whereas in 51, we are still pretty sore from the Second World War, where the Germans were thoroughly baddies and not considered noble whatsoever at all anymore.
So I don't think there are many more explicit moments, but that is a thing worth bearing in mind in terms of the attitudes.
I think it may come into play at the end of the film as well, possibly.
I was finding myself wondering, what are the missionaries eating once the village... all the villagers have gone off, either to be conscripted or just running away.
Presumably they trashed all the food stores.
Well,
that they
had. Every structure has burned at least a bit.
Yes.
My guess is the missionaries have some sort of tinned food or whatever, and they're eating that and wondering what to do next. But yeah. It is basically just Rose at this point. So.
It is Rose. Her brother is, unfortunately for us, no more Robert Morley. He's on his way out. Fortunately for Rose, the African Queen comes back because Charlie went back to the mine where he was going to do more trading / working. I'm not quite clear whether he worked at the mine or traded it, but it doesn't matter. The Germans have done the same thing at the mine. They've destroyed it. It's not safe and they need to get out of
Africa. Basically, he is the main mine supply run.
Yes.
And then he happens to mention the stuff that he's got on board, which was supplies for the mine. In other words, mining explosives and oxygen tanks.
This is the wages of fear all over again. Except, unfortunately, it's not nitroglycerine and will not explode at the slightest wobble.
But this is competent mining explosive. But also, this is basically where we get the thrust of the plot, because Charlie is essentially, I'm pissed off, but I'm just one guy, what can I do about it? The British are out there, but there is this large lake downriver to which the Germans have brought a gunboat, and therefore the British cannot attack through that.
And there's a fortress on the way to it down the river.
Yeah, that's secondary. Because Rose's plan is, you know, if somebody was to sink that gunboat, for example, with a small boat full of high explosives.
Yes, she's straight away, for king and country, it's her duty to do her part for the war. Not to mention she's thoroughly pissed off with the Germans having ruined her life.
But also, this is basically the starting point of the gradually developing relationship, because at this point, Charlie is clearly saying, well, you know, if I don't say yes, she's just going to keep going on at me, and I'm going to go downriver anyway. Maybe I can get her to change her mind.
That's his plan. Basically,
this is all portrayed non-verbally, I should point out.
Yes,
exactly. It's so clear, I feel confident in saying it.
It is very clear that, yes, he goes along with it on the basis that it's never going to happen. She's just excited. But he lays out in sort of classic... At this point, we have the whole rest of the film laid out for us in that Charlie tells us what's going to happen. We got the... you can't do this. There's the rapids. And then beyond the rapids, there's the fortress. And then beyond the fortress, there's the reeds. And you'll never get through the reeds. And then even if you did, you'll just get blown up by the boat when you get to the lake. To which Rose basically says, well, so what? We're doing it. Yeah. So they head off, and largely, I think, because they don't have a ton of other options. I mean, over land, they'd be in significant trouble wherever they went, so they might as well try the river.
Yeah, I don't think either of these people is particularly equipped for living off the land the way a local might be able to.
I'm not entirely... I guess he has some food supplies on board, but presumably they don't have a lot, because you couldn't fit a lot on the boat.
Mm.
So they do. They head off, and they are, again, this is classic road movie. They are, as we've seen portrayed in the lovely earlier scene, they are very different characters. We have this very English, proper lady with a sense of duty to God and her country, and we have Charlie, who has basically none of those things. He's sort of a comedy alcoholic a bit, in a way. I mean, it's not played for laughs.
We never actually see him drunk. He is just constantly drinking.
Well, there is a moment when he's drunk at the... There's one when he decides to go. I think he's drunk at that point, and he agrees to it and passes out. But he doesn't... He's not sort of inappropriate or anything like that. He's just... less patient, a bit more offensive with it. That happens a little bit later. So they set off down the river.
Yeah, the first stage is easy, and you know, she learns a bit about steering the boat, because the steam engine is clearly needing constant attention.
So the plan, I wanted to ask you about this technically. So the plan is to make some torpedoes in the, well, not really torpedoes so much as explosive rams.
The term torpedo shifted over time.
Right.
And I suspect this is Forrester being specifically accurate to the period. Torpedo in, say, the 1860s basically is what we would now call a marine mine.
Right, okay. So that makes sense, yes.
And when they start getting engines in them, which is really only about this point historically, they are called dirigible torpedoes.
Which, and then and they eventually just became
to the primary meaning torpedo, yeah.
Okay, but what they're proposing basically is the explosives in a casing with a detonator at the front, and then like a nail that sets off a bullet.
Well,
which
that's
then
the detonator.
Triggers.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because he has the mining explosives. He does not have detonators for them because obviously you don't ship those together if you possibly can. But the idea is basically mount these things onto the front of the boat, ram the boat into it, and that will. The inertia of that will hold them in place long enough to blow up usefully.
So it is plausible, then.
It's way smaller than most marine mines. But on the other hand, Roger's naval corner here, it's not much of a gunboat.
It's quite a small boat, isn't it, considering?
By the standards of the location, yeah, it is the overpowering force. But... it was inspired by... I can't remember now. There was an actual gunboat that was basically brought in pieces over land to the lake during the war.
Lake Victoria. That rings a bell, yes, yes.
But that had a 1 3-inch and 1 4-inch gun. And that's it.
That's it, but I guess there's nothing else comparable there. So it's still the biggest fish in the lake.
If nobody else has a 3-inch or a 4-inch gun, then you can shoot them before they can shoot you.
I guess we should say this is a giant African lake. I'm not sure they specify, but it's, you know, along the lines. I think they filmed it on Lake Albert, which is enormous. So
yeah.
It's a great lake rather than just a lake. So they set off down there, then they encounter the rapids, or the easy part of the rapids, and Rose has a great time. Turns out she's a bit of an adrenaline junkie, having never done it before. She rockets over the rapids, has a wonderful time, which is, this is, I think, when Charlie gets drunk, because his plan was basically give her a taste of the rapids, she'll panic, and that's it. We're done. And then we can think of something else.
And I've made a note here. It is so nice to see an actual boat going down actual rapids rather than CGI or a model or something, even if we do have to have back projection for our heroes inside her.
I mean, it always looks fake. But
I've talked about that before with Casablanca, particularly, that it was... At the time, it was just everybody knew that this means you are inside a vehicle and that this is just how we portray it. To me, I've always found it distracting, but yeah.
I agree, but yes, I also agree. It's clearly not a model, or was it a smaller version of the Africa? I'm not sure how they
filmed it. No, they had an actual boat. That boat still exists.
And they pushed it down. I mean, it does look great.
It's now somewhere around the Florida Keys, but yeah.
Oh, I should have to visit that someday.
But Florida.
Well, yes, exactly. Satan's ball sack weather might not be too conducive to examining it. So this is when I believe Charlie overdoes it with the gin, and he's pissed off, and he's quite short with her, and they really do clash.
Mm-hmm.
He falls asleep, whether it's a drunken stupor or not, I don't know, but he wakes up to Rose pouring his entire collection of gin, which is extensive, into the river.
And this, it occurred to me, is where that bonfire of rum in Pirates of the Caribbean comes from.
Right,
it's
yes.
Basically the same scene.
Yes. I
noted that if he actually were seriously alcohol dependent, then a sudden cessation of drinking like that is the way to bring on delirium treatments and kill him.
Yes, exactly.
She, of course, would not know that, and she gets lucky, and so does he.
She's lucky that he's not as alcoholic as he's portrayed, because he would either be non-functional or dead for the rest of the film. But he has a hangover, he copes with it. I guess you see a bit of his character here, in that rather than going batshit crazy and throwing her off the boat and smashing things up, he is just a bit annoyed, but he... comes to accept it was probably a good idea that he stops drinking. And I suppose for me, here's where some of the, I don't know, I don't know quite what it is about the African Queen, but some of the cracks here appear to me, because I don't, they're fantastic actors. I've loved them in other films. For whatever reason, for me, I don't buy the relationship. I just don't. It doesn't work for me, or I'm not invested in it, so I'm not that bothered when it becomes more of a relationship. And unfortunately, that is kind of the point of the film, which is why it falls slightly flat for me.
There's also a bit missing, because we are obviously in the Studio Code era.
Yes.
And in the book, Forrester makes it not obviously explicit, because this is still 1935, but he makes it clear that they have been sleeping together at some point, or from some point.
Well, it makes it human. They're in this situation. They might die at the end of it. Yes, it would. I mean, no, I think seeing that would have spoiled it, and there couldn't have been any suggestion of it.
But the point is that that is an element of the emotional progression that can be used in the book.
Yes.
That the film cannot use.
No, well, we get, so, I guess from this scene, I mean, it's kind of clear where it's going right from the setup, really, but from this scene where she throws the stuff away, I don't know, the way he'd been playing his character, because he's basically a bum with a heart of gold in some ways, but I thought he would have reacted more and got angrier, and because he's just a bit flatter and like, oh, okay, well, I'm a bit annoyed. I don't know, it felt like not a reaction I was expecting, and not in a genuine way, and for some reason from then on, it just didn't quite work for me. It seemed unearned there.
I don't know whether it's underplaying.
Yes, could be.
Or I have seen other romances of this sort of era, and I have not felt like this about them. So I don't think it's just the style of the time. But
so it's you as well, is it?
Yeah.
Do you feel okay? That's interesting. I have seen it before, and I loved it, and I remembered really loving it. So I thought I'd really enjoy it this time. And it is an enjoyable film, but the central core of it. I don't know why. It just doesn't work. Whether a different pair of, again, excellent actors would have worked better for me. I don't know. And I agree with you. It's not that they're not acting their socks off. You know, there is a lot of non-verbal communication and a lot of sideways glances. And I don't know. It just doesn't quite work for me. But
the fort.
The fort, they progress, they make it through the rapids, Rose, and this is where the relationship's supposed to burgeon a bit. Rose is really flipping loving it, and, really flipping loving the rapids, and Charlie sort of comes to admire her bravery, and her spunk, for want of a better term. Of course there's none of that given the, motion picture code, but they then arrive at the German fort, and their plan is to sail past it.
Yeah, now this is a tricky bit, because the book obviously has the space to explain a bit more, which is
right.
there is a town at the fort, or there is a fort at the town, however you want to look at it, and everybody knows that the rapids below the fort are completely impassable. So the German commander assumes when he sees a boat that this boat is coming into the town docks to surrender, because there
right,
is nowhere
else
to go.
Because no one would go past, yes.
And that is what delays his response. The thing that surprised me, and I don't know whether this is a difference from the book or not, is that this is a fort. One of the things you do with a fort is mount artillery on it.
Mm.
Especially if it's covering a river choke point. I mean, yes, all right, guns are big and heavy, but yeah, I would honestly expect at least some mortars or something.
Thankfully they don't. I mean, they have rifles and yeah. machine guns. And they, I mean, why didn't they go past it in the dark though? I don't know quite.
I think that was a consideration. They mentioned that earlier. Basically the navigation is quite tricky at that point as well.
Oh, that's right. And if they hit the rapids in the dark, they're dead. Good point. Yes. Okay. But so they sort of take the chances and lie down flat. and basically take an assault from the forge.
But fortunately, it's only bolt action rifles.
Now, they have pointed out earlier that these explosives, you could shoot a bullet into them and they still wouldn't go off. So that's good news, because they get a lot of bullets shot into them. Neither of them get shot. The boat takes fairly minimal damage. And thanks to a bit of dazzling of the... Because they're clearly setting up the commander to be the one who gets the kill shot. And then he gets dazzled by the sun as they... That's right. They do decide to go in when the sun will be in their eyes, which is Rosa's idea. So that's right. It's coming back to me now. They were smarter than I thought.
Yeah.
Then they hit the third rapids, and these really are pretty tricky rapids.
These are the ones that everybody thinks are impossible, yeah.
And they're not far off, because they snap the propeller, or they snap off the blades on the propeller.
They also lose the awning, and I understand that visually you need to portray this. You know, we are starting off with hats, and we are prim and proper, and we are gradually losing our hats as we become more free and romantic. But particularly once you lose the canopy, keep your head out of the sun, please.
Yes, exactly, yes. This is Africa, after all. But they don't suffer from a lethal sunburn. What they do is hold up and repair the propeller. And it's a nice moment, because Charlie shows he really is a skilled mechanic. In dire situations, he can sort it out, put things together.
Yeah, and here is... I believe you have not read any Forrester, but I can see the Forrester technical bit, because he loves his technical bits in the Hornblower books.
Yes, I think it's probably played down in the film, but we do see he does talk through what he needs to do to repair the propeller. And at first it's like, I can't do that. And it moved with Rose's encouragement. You can do anything, Charlie, basically, because they're already good friends at this point. He does manage to weld on a new blade onto the shaft. How long it would last, they're not sure, but it doesn't have to last that long, because they just need to get through the last bit of the rapids.
Also, I'd just like to mention that there is a science fiction book which had been published before the film was made, though after this book was written, in which two people crashed on a moon of, I think it's Jupiter, in a fragment of spaceship, casually progressed from basic blacksmithing to a hydroelectric power plant. Yes, it's Space Sounds of the IPC. Good old Doc Smith.
They're not quite manufacturing jetpacks here. I like it because it's a little tribute to the simplicity of things. If you've got a simple machine, easily repairable, and that's what you generally have in Africa. Even now, you go for the simpler stuff that you can fix quite easily, rather than the all singing, all dancing stuff.
Because apart from the circuit board, getting a replacement may take months.
Yes. So it's a lovely... I really like the...
This is also a thing that shows up in A Ship of the Line, the first of the Hornblower books written. Basically, you know, the ship can get fairly wrecked in battle, but given a reasonably safe anchorage in the middle of nowhere, they have the people and skills to, you know, let's have a new mainmast. Yes, we can do this. That kind
basically
of thing.
Rebuild the whole thing.
Yeah.
Which they don't quite do with the African Queen, but they patch it back together, or Charlie patches it back together, and they head on into the last section of the river. The problem at this point is it's just a very wide reed bed, stretches out as far as the eye can see. There's very little current, and it's very hard to work out which way to go. And while they continue forward as best they can, they eventually seem to have taken a dead end, and they've run out of water, they've run out of food, they've got no cover, and basically they know that they're going to die at this point. So they stuck in the mud, they fall asleep, and would you know it, there's a huge rainstorm, and it lifts them up, and they are drifting. It turns out they were only a few hundred yards from the lake, and they drift out into the lake. They've made it. And at this point, they're a couple, really. I mean, that they've broken the taboo in that they've kissed, which I guess in this era is basically making love. And they are a couple. And I, again, unconvinced as I remain, I still, you know, they're still a likeable couple. I just didn't buy them as a couple. I like them individually. But here we are. End of the line.
That stuff is very much for the film. The book is much more, I mean, yes, they're getting on. Yes, they're getting, they are falling in love with each other. But the whole romantic comedy element is much more in the film.
So is Forrester a funny writer particularly?
Not particularly. No, by romantic comedy, I mean the whole sparring back and forth thing. He's not doing that. He doesn't really like writing women in the first place, I think.
No. I think a lot of that came from semi-improvisation from Bogie and Hepburn, because they are, again, excellent actors.
But this is also very much where the book diverges from the film. So let's talk about the film first.
Okay. So they're in the lake. They see the Kernighan Luisa, is that right? The German gunboat, such mm-hmm. that it is, in the distance.
It's actually the steam tug Buganda that was used to show this. And it's not wildly off the First World War. The actual vessel that inspired this was the Graf Goetzen, operating on Lake Tanganyika. But yeah,
which wasn't blown up by a small
scuttled after a battle, or during a battle. But we'll come back to that. That boat, again, is still afloat, still working as a ferry, at least this decade. I don't know if you're doing it right now.
Wow. That's exciting. They head out into the lake. Torpedoes, as we've discussed, pointing out at the front of the African Queen. And in under the cover of darkness, they are going to just slide into it. Presumably point it at the ship, then jump off the back of the African Queen.
Having the big argument about which of them is going to go, and no, actually we both need to go. Because they know perfectly well that the jumping off at the last minute is not a high survival strategy.
No, not a reliable technique. Yeah, so it's a very risky procedure. Unfortunately, the weather strikes again. There is a huge storm, and the poor old African Queen survives so much, is sunk by the storm. And they are dropped into the drink. And the next morning, they are both rescued, or Charlie is rescued from the water.
They are rescued separately. This is quite important, yeah.
Yes, Charlie is rescued and taken in front of the German officer, where he's interrogated. It's pretty gentle interrogation, really, but he...
I think... Even the Germans, as in the, especially in the novel, but even to some extent in the book, they are right out at the end of their power structure.
Mm.
Yeah, they're going to have to send in a report, but basically they're not super motivated, except in things that might actually endanger their ship.
So they're not terribly, they assume he's some kind of spy. He doesn't defend himself, largely because he thinks Rose has died. And so he's not really interested in anything anymore. So they pretty swiftly, or the captain pretty swiftly, Peter Bull, very nice, expressive face, the captain, Peter Bull.
Yeah, we may even talk about him next episode.
We may do. But he, as you say, he clearly got better things to do. He's not terribly interested in this. He pretty swiftly pronounces a death sentence on Charlie.
It is time of war.
Yes, and he is a spy, so they're going to hang him from the front of the ship. But at that point, they...
Well, from the yardarm, it's traditional.
Oh, yeah, of course. I never thought of that. Rose is brought on board, having also survived the storm, and unlike Charlie, she pretty much confesses everything, that she was going to blow up the ship, and... I mean, it doesn't matter because they're already... Charlie's already sentenced to death. She's pretty likely to be sentenced to death, but they're so overjoyed to see each other again. And here my heart did... it was warmed a little. My cockles were slightly warmed by this scene. I did enjoy the...
You need a better protective layer of clinker.
I did enjoy the delight they have in each other. And the part where the film almost... It almost melted my heart was where they're taken outside. Again, they are very quickly decided to be hanged together, or they want to be hanged together. And the last request is that Charlie asks well, let's get married. We might as well. And the captain...
He asks the captain. He does not ask her. I mean, yes, on the one hand, they can do it by eye contact, but...
Fortunately, she's into the idea. In fact, delighted. But yes, I agree. It's not so much a proposal as can you technically marry us? Go on then. But I liked it. I liked it because she's so overjoyed. Because I would read that as he doesn't need to ask her.
Yeah, I mean, that's a valid reading. I just start to feel a little edgy here.
Yeah, fair enough. They are taken to the yardarm, and they even have the nooses around their neck. But at this point, the incredibly fortuitously, and this, I think, is quite different from the book.
I'll come back to that in just a moment, yeah.
The capsized African Queen, still with its torpedoes poking out, happens to bump into the gunboat, blows it up, and destroys it. And the two, again, even more incredibly, our two heroes manage to escape the sinking ship, avoid all the other Germans, and swim off to... I don't know what's going to happen to them next. But they are alive for the minute, and they've survived a lot more, so...
Well, one might assume, simply on the basis of what's been said in the film, that with that gunboat gone, the British can move in.
Yes, hopefully.
So, the book is quite different from here, basically from the River Delta. And it is a long portage rather than poking through the reeds. There is no moment of divine intervention. They make it to the lake.
Yeah, right.
The Queen does still sink during the attack, and they're still rescued, but Louisa's captain feels that it would be uncivilized to execute them. So he hands them over to the British commander.
See, this is the difference, isn't it? Where he behaves very honourably.
And the British commander then goes on to sink Louise with his own forces. So there's no, you know, the whole torpedoes thing just never happens.
That's interesting, isn't it? That's quite a different... I can see why they changed it, because it makes our hero's journey pretty pointless.
He then tells Allnut, you need to enlist in the South African army. They're just over there. and Charlie and Rose agree to get married.
Okay, very different. It's quite similar to Casablanca, and he enlists and starts to fight the war at the end of it. Oh, spoilers for Casablanca.
Forrester is not immune in Hornblower to our heroes have a vastly inferior force but succeed by trickery. I mean, I don't think he would object to the film plot particularly. I don't believe he ever went on record about it. But in this particular case, he was much more, here is the conventional solution.
Yes. I mean, I think, I don't know what style the is it a short story or it's a novel, is it?
I think it's a novella.
Novella, okay.
Long novella, short novel, something like that.
I don't know what sort of style it is, but I mean, The African Queen, the film, is kind of an action. It's a road movie, but also an action adventure. And I think it did need that kind of ending. It stretches credulity that they happen to, in this enormous lake, they just happen to bump into, at the exact moment, bump into the remnants of the African Queen. But, and that's a good thing, because if it had been left there, it would have been a tremendous shipping hazard. Anyway, I think it did need that kind of action ending and that kind of underlie. That would have been a really underwhelming ending to the film. So I don't begrudge that ending.
No, I agree. I just think it's interesting to see the different approaches.
Yes.
And it was not a... The book was not a failure. So...
Well, the film was an enormous success.
So... I think where this failed for me, and I basically needed to rotate my perception slightly to enjoy it more. I strongly suspect because I've read most of Hornblower now. It's very much incident by incident.
Yeah, yes.
Here is the problem. Here is how we solve it. Here is the character building moment. Now we go on to the next problem, which means. Yeah, the individual episodes are lovely, but there isn't the gradually ascending tension of what I think of as a novel-length work.
Yes.
You could shuffle several of these episodes out of order and it wouldn't significantly break things.
Yeah, it's very kind of picaresque kind of style, similar to Apocalypse Now and a lot of other of those sorts of films.
And similarly, you because we lose that extra bit of relationship that the book could have and the film couldn't, that takes out some of the oomph as well. But the thing that I was able to appreciate when I put myself more into the 1951 viewer mindset, nature footage with a three-strip Technicolor camera. Nobody was doing that.
Yes, that was... It's beautiful. If you compare it to other films of the time, which it obviously sets, just nothing like actual African footage that we have here.
I mean, for us, it's trivial. We've seen Attenborough, we've seen all the other stuff. But, yeah, Weissmuller's Tarzan run only ends in 1948.
Oh, really? Okay, so just a few years before this.
And they are still making Tarzan films with his replacement at this point. So... Yeah, that's a
good way of looking at it. The technical achievement, and it's a beautiful looking film, absolutely. And the actors are amazing, except here for me, as I say, they fail for various reasons. You know, we talk about the events in the background. You could shuffle them around, and really, the idea is they're a backdrop to this relationship that's burgeoning, and even the climax is really. It's a climax of their relationship. Again, not in that way because we weren't allowed to, but you know, it's the fulfillment of their relationship. Basically, they, they've already said they love it. And in a way, that's
of course, another thing we would tend to miss, I suspect, unless we think about it, is the social aspect. And original yes. Charlie is very much a prol, and Canadian Charlie is perhaps a bit less so because he's played by a guy. That guy.
Yes.
But even so, there is a class distinction. And they anywhere else, they would simply never have met or talked to each other.
Talking it through, I wonder if part of the problem for me is they almost get together too quickly. They go from pretty antagonistic to, I love you, without a lot in between. I found it quite a quick, and I perhaps wasn't quite ready for it. So by the point where they get married at the end, as I say, that it doesn't need, she doesn't need to be asked because they already know it, but they've already kind of professed their love for each other a while back in the film.
This is only 105 minutes.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's not a long, it doesn't have a lot of time to play. For whatever reason, the relationship didn't, quite. I didn't hate it. Of course, they're very watchable people, and I love the film. But for me, the fundamental core of it doesn't work. And without that kind of relationship, the rest of the film, is actually quite shallow, like the African Queen's Bottom.
I like it more looking back at it now than I did yes. 10 minutes after I'd watched it.
I think that's fair. Yeah, I remembered loving it the first time, and this time. Perhaps I built myself up too much. I was like, oh, it's a John Huston film. It's got Bogie in it. It's got Catherine Hepburn. It's exactly the sort of thing I love. And I do like it for all those reasons, but it doesn't quite rise above that. And the central premise, by which I mean the relationship, doesn't work for me, sadly. It's a shame.
I would like to mention a couple of production notes. Lake Tanganyika is all shot in, well, all the location shooting is done in the Belgian Congo rather than on actual Lake Tanganyika, because Huston had heard that the elephant hunting was better there.
Let's not get dragged into the Belgian Congo, shall we? That's a whole different kettle of horrors.
Quite a small part. The second officer of the Princess Louise... who is the guy who's doing the actual interrogation. He's on the right in the initial shots of that. He's the guy who stands up and does some of the actual interrogation. Here's Walter Gotell, whom I thought he looked familiar. And, yeah, that is General Gogol from several James Bond films in later years.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, I see. Yes, that is worth Googling because you'll recognise the face, certainly. Oh, yes, very nice. Right, well, there we are, the African Queen.
It doesn't need us to boost it. It won one Oscar for Bogart and was nominated for three more.
It did very well, and one of Houston's best successes. Not one of my favourites of his, though. I mean, Houston, apart from The Dead, is always watchable. Bogart is always watchable. I've never seen a non-watchable Bogart film or a non-watchable Katharine Hepburn film. So by all means, watch it, and I hope you enjoy the relationship more than we did.
I think, to be fair, it is that thing that we've seen with a number of other films, which is when everybody raves about it, all it can do is disappoint a little bit because nothing is as good as the thing that everybody raved about.
True. But the person who was raving about it was my own head telling me how much I'd enjoyed it. So I don't know quite how that worked. But there we are. Good stuff. But for me, probably a technical masterpiece. I'll give it that. But for me personally, I wouldn't argue with people who said it was a masterpiece, but for me it's not.
I think I probably would.
Yeah, fair. Yeah. I just said I wouldn't argue, so I can't.
let us not speak of the 1977 television film, which was intended as the pilot for a series of The Further Adventures of Charlie and Rose.
Oh, God. What were they on? A different boat, presumably. I can see at some point somebody might have thought that was a good idea. Well, there we are.
The series didn't get made, so it wasn't that good an idea.
Well, I think it's time for us to paddle off arm in arm into the horizon and to our uncertain future.